Welcome to Uncommons. I'm Nate Erskine-Smith, and on this episode, I'm joined by Environment Minister Stephen Guilbeault, an activist by all accounts before he entered politics in 2019, including as co-founder of the Quebec-based environmental advocacy organization Équiterre and as the director of a provincial chapter of Greenpeace. He served a brief stint as heritage minister before his appointment as environment minister in 2021. And in his current role, he has one of the most important fights on his hands. That's defending serious climate policy in the face of conservative efforts to undermine that work, including the consistent lies from Pierre Poilievre to axe serious climate action. You can actually read a post of mine, a recent post on that specific topic at uncommons.ca. I encourage you to check it out, which is now home both to this podcast, as well as some regular writing on different issues of the day, including that climate action piece. We cannot back down on serious climate action. So in the course of this conversation, of course, we talk climate and nature policy, but much of the conversation is also centered on communication. After all, if you can't communicate your policies effectively, they won't be policies that last. Stephen, thanks so much for joining me.
My pleasure, Nate.
So you've been the environment minister for quite some time now, and in cabinet fairly quickly, all things considered, first as heritage minister. You have an interesting background, though, and that's where I want to start, because you have said yourself you came into politics so you could continue to be an activist. You were certainly an activist, a progressive. You co-founded Équiterre in Quebec, director of provincial chapter of Greenpeace. To much fanfare, probably positively in some quarters and negatively in others, you've been arrested for your climate activism, including for scaling the CN Tower with a banner. What did the banner say? Canada and Bush, climate killers, in 2001, I think. So, you know, you've got that track record and history behind you. You've been, on the one hand, called sort of a loony left environment minister. Ford's called you an extremist. On the other side, you probably have the activists that you were with before politics who are saying, oh, he's too pragmatic, he's not doing enough. how do you, first off, why the Liberal Party? Why, if such an activist, why not the Green Party, why not the NDP?
It's a good question, Nate. I mean, I've been offered a few times to run before, whether it was municipal, provincial, or federal politics. Whenever someone asks, you think about it, if only out of respect for the person asking and why they're doing it. But I never really seriously considered it until the Prime Minister approached me. Well, first it was actually Gerald Butts in the spring or summer of 2018. I've known him for a long time when he was in provincial politics and then head of WWF Canada. So Jerry's someone I've known for a long time. And he said to me, he said he knew, and I had publicly, applauded some of the things that the party did between 2015 and 2018. He also knew there were things I disagreed with, like the pipeline in my previous career. But he said, listen, we're trying to get the country on a different path when it comes to tackling climate change. And we've done some things, and I know you like some of them and I know you don't others, but we need you to continue and to help us accelerate that. and if we lose the 2019 election, then what we've started doing is going down. It's going down the drain. And I, for the first time in my life, really, I started thinking about it very seriously, and I thought, okay, well, what if I go with the NDP or the Greens? And I have friends. I mean, Elizabeth May is a personal friend of mine, and our friendship has withstand the fact that I decided to join the Liberals and not the Greens. I mean, she'll criticize me whenever she feels like she has to, but we're still friends. And same, in the progressive movement, some would have certainly preferred that I went to the NDP. I mean, basically, the reason I came to the Liberal Party is because of the fact, the things they had started doing, and I felt that I could add my energy and experience and efforts to what they were doing, And if I was to go with the Greens or the NDP, for whom I have, a lot of respect, it would be, in a way, continue to do what I was doing as an activist. As an activist, you propose things, you make suggestions, you criticize, but you never get to implement things. You never get to, because that's the nature of the work. And I felt that it was highly unlikely that either the Greens or the NDP would come into power anytime soon. And I had a real shot with the Liberals, based on what they had started to do to contribute to bring this to even further in terms of environmental protection, climate change, and plastic and nature.
And you probably never thought you were going to be the heritage minister. I don't know. That was maybe a rude
Oh, no.
awakening in some ways on some files.
It's
But
really interesting, because when so the election happens and then you get a call from someone and okay, well, we'd like to have a conversation. And, there's a few steps before you actually get to talk to the prime minister. And as I was getting closer to that meeting with the prime minister, people kept telling me, keep your mind open in terms of what might happen. And one person says it and you say, okay, but then it's two or three and you say, okay, I'm clearly not becoming environment minister. What is it going to be? And the prime minister told me, and I
yeah,
was
trial by
surprised.
fire. And now you're in though a role that you do have a comfort zone. This is what you've lived for. This is what you've dedicated your politics before politics to. How do you, though? I mean, I quoted a few more negative comments from conservative leaders off the hop there, but you've also been described as a radical pragmatist. How do you go back to the activist world, your Greenpeace, your Ecaterres, and you say to them, Bay du Nord, and they shake their heads at you, and you say $35 billion for TMX, and they shake your heads at you, and then you say, yeah. I don't agree with all that's happened, sometimes before me, sometimes even during the time I've been at the table. But look at all of the progress. What is your example of where you've been at the table to make a difference?
Mean, I said earlier that despite not choosing the Greens, Elizabeth May continues to be a friend. I have not lost any friends from when I was in the environmental movement, activist friends, since I've been in politics, and even after things like Bay du Nord. That being said, people in the environmental movement, when they feel they have to criticize me, don't shy away from doing it, and they certainly did so when the Bay du Nord announcement was made, and I mean, it was a they were very, very unhappy that day, and they didn't shy away from saying it publicly, and it was a pretty shitty day for me. I got you know what it is. You're in Ottawa, you're
Yeah.
by
Oh, yeah.
yourself, you get home and there's nothing in the fridge because you're never there. And
And
around
on
eight
that
o'clock
day, you might have thought, "What am I doing this for?" And but then you wake up and you're at the table for another decision, and then and you're mo able to move it in the direction you want to move it.
Well, actually, that evening when I was all by myself home eating spaghetti for yet another time, because it's so easy. That's what I end up eating most of the time. But the phone started, people started texting, Messenger, messaging me, and saying, we were hard on you today, but you're still our favorite environment minister. And not one, but not two, but a bunch of people. So
That's good.
I think a lot of people in the movement, not everyone, but I think a lot of people understand what we're trying to do. And I think more and more, and probably more than ever, they understand the constraints, whether they're internal or external, to bringing about the change that people like you and I want to see happen in this country. And in fact, I mean, if and I was having this conversation with a journalist the other day, who was pointing out that more and more we see environmentalists praising, not becoming fans or card-carrying members of the Liberal Party, but more and more saying good things about what we're doing, whether it's fossil fuel subsidies, whether it's what we did at COP15 and what we're doing on nature, whether it's ZEV, methane, the clean electricity regulations. Like, people say this is very good. We want more, and environmentalists will always, as they should, want more. But so I think there is a growing understanding in the movement, and it's not unanimous, and some people will really don't like what we're doing. But I think I'd say I'd venture to say the majority of them, I think, are understand what we're doing.
And when it comes to what we're doing, you'll get criticisms to say you're not doing enough, there's more to do. I've seen you say back, there is more to do, and there's an acknowledgement that we've come a long way, but we're not where we need to be just yet. But let's talk about how far we've come, because I worry, and I want to get to the axe the tax silliness and communications in a moment. But before we get there, this isn't really just about axing the tax. This is about axing serious climate action. And this is about taking us back to well before 2015, where we haven't had this serious climate action in this country that we've had since. And it's not perfect, and I will be the first to call TMX a boondoggle, but we have seen 815 projected megatons drop down to, I think, if all implemented policies, what you were doing analyze, the Canadian Climate Institute just said it's 226 million tons that are already reduced as far as projected 2030 emissions go if implemented policies hold. And that's not even accounting for what's in progress, what's been announced. And you've got a lot more work to do to make sure the in progress and announced measures are as stringent as
Land,
possible. But how do you articulate that progress?
I think the way you did. I mean, when first, I mean, if we lose the next election, and I've played in that movie in 2006 when Harper won his first election. I was at Équiterre. One of the first program to go, a number of organizations across the country, including Équiterre, were being partly funded by the federal government and provincial governments, and depending on provinces, to do home energy audits for low-income Canadians. So, two people would go in, a technician and an advisor. They would sit down. Like, my writing is the third poorest writing in the country. So, lots of doors in my writing we knocked on during those days. Sit down with the people who are almost 100% renters, and look at them at, what are the changes that they could implement in their household that would help them save 10, 15, 18, maybe 20% on their electricity bill. We're not talking like deep energy retrofits. Basically, small interventions, which the technicians would do while the advisor was there talking to the person. That's the first program that Harper cut. Hundreds of those home energy experts lost their jobs because we couldn't sustain it anymore. I think we at Équiterre, we had to let go of 15, 12, 15 people working with us, and that was the beginning, and we know, because they've said so, that if Pierre Poilievre wins the next election, then obviously it's carbon pricing that's going to go, it's support for electrification that's going to go, it's support for home energy retrofit that's going to go, it's a support for heat pumps that is going to go, it's the support for nature protection, and especially indigenous-led nature protection. So all of these things are gone. And I think, how do I explain the progress we've made? I think the way you do. I mean, when we came in, we were going to overshoot our 2030 targets because Harper had no plan, despite making a commitment to reduce emissions in Copenhagen. And now our plan is starting to work. But yeah, as the Climate Institute and a couple of other independent shops have shown, like, we can get there. We can actually meet, for the first time in the history of this country, a climate target. But we need, like, if we stop implementing measures come whenever the election is 2025, then we won't, obviously. But so we need to continue. And you and I would argue we need to accelerate the deployment of those
So I
measures.
want to pick up on something you said there. So this idea that we haven't yet met a climate target, it is the height of cynicism, I think, for the conservatives to say you've never met a climate target, but the reason we haven't is because of their
Exactly.
government.
No,
And because you
exactly.
can't just on a dime change policies in clean electricity, change policies on pollution pricing, change policies on ZEVs, zero emission vehicles, change policies to make sure there are chargers for those ZEVs, you change policies on methane emissions, on phasing out coal-fired electricity. There's a suite of comprehensive, serious policies here, some that need to be ratcheted up for sure, but you can't on a dime change your economy in that way. And of course, we're not going to meet the first emissions target as far as it goes. But what is at stake is meeting the next one. I don't know. I don't know the idea that we would be attacked for it by conservatives who don't want us in the end to meet it is just galling politics. Which gets me to the other very cynical piece, because you mentioned that your riding is the third poorest in the country. This idea that conservatives have woken up one day and they're concerned about food bank lines, this idea that conservatives have woken up one day and they're concerned about poor people, and they're weaponizing this ostensible concern to undermine the most efficient and effective way to tackle climate change that actually makes the people in your riding, the poorest people, better off. It doesn't make everyone better off. The top 20% of income earners are not necessarily better off. Certainly the biggest polluters are not better off. But the lowest income folks are better off. And we can have a debate around, and I want to get to the PBO report because I think there's a credible debate to be had there around the economic costs of climate action. But I mean, how do you manage the communications here? It's losing communication so far is what any pundit will tell you. I don't think the fight's done by any means, and we got to take the fight to those who are opposing serious climate action on carbon pricing, who are opposed to the revenue neutrality of it, who spread misinformation. What do you see going forward needs to happen to shift that fight, to make sure that the Wob Kanoos of the world and the Bonnie Crombies of the world don't, shy away from a leadership role on this?
So, I mean, there's the disinformation and the outright lies are incredible. I mean, you might have seen this piece at the end of last week where Pierre Poilievre said that there was a fight in a food bank here in Montreal because of carbon pricing.
That's crazy.
First,
It's madness.
carbon pricing, the federal carbon pricing system does not apply in Quebec. Quebec has had its system for a decade. It's different. It's called cap and trade. Ontario had it under Premier Wynne. Quebec is doing this with California. And even the people from the food bank said, "What? Carbon pricing? Hold on a second. This why we call the police has nothing to do with climate change or number one. Number two, I think we were a bit complacent for a while. I think, carbon pricing was part of the 2015 election and we won. It was one of the issues in 2019 and we won. And it was part of the debate in 2021 and we won. So I think for some of us, this issue was behind us. And we thought, I think collectively, people thought that, Pierre Poilievre was talking about this, but we didn't think, I think many people didn't think it would get traction. Clearly, those people were wrong. It is getting traction. And which is now why we have to redouble our efforts to explain to Canadians, what is the federal carbon pricing system? What is the rebate? What did the parliamentary budget officer say? And the caveats that he himself has put around some of the analysis that he's put out there.
And
So,
can I let's pause there. So I said this to you in caucus in passing at one point, but a while ago now, my family went to the movies and there was an ad from Environment Canada. And honestly, my impression of that ad is that Environment Canada likes canoes or likes nature, and that's nice. It's like, oh, we care about nature. We care. We've passed the threshold question of caring. So if you care about climate change, sure, Environment Canada and the government today cares about climate change too. Great. I walk out knowing that someone cares. But I don't walk out thinking that the government is taking it seriously in any substantive way. And on carbon pricing in particular, if I go to the Emissions Progress Report, there's laid out, I think, a very spirited defense of carbon pricing that doesn't exist in our broader paid communications. There are obviously challenges to partisan advertising. You don't want to go down that road in any way. And Harper, obviously, the economic action plan was something we've pushed back against. But educating Canadians about the role that carbon pricing plays, educating Canadians about the way that it works and how the rebates work, is that on the table as far as paid advertising goes?
So that particular campaign you referred to was done, well, was largely baked in before I arrived. One of the things I've done since being nominated Environment Minister is to bring in outside help in communications with the department, but also with the government as a whole. I know the Privy Council, for example, has a group of experts looking at behavioral sciences on issues like environment, not just climate change, but including climate change. And if you look at the last campaign we did, public education campaign we did, to actually air during the Super Bowl, you'll see that the language is different, the approach is different. It's not specifically on carbon pricing. It's more generally speaking about climate change and what some of the actions are started to be taken and what people and governments can and are doing in this country. But I agree with you. I think we need something specific about explaining, what carbon pricing is, what it isn't, and help people better understand, because we haven't been doing a very good job of explaining it.
So let's get to two points. One more recent, but let's start with the PBO report. And for those listening who haven't read the report, I was on the radio recently, and a conservative talk show radio host was sort of banging away and misquoting the PBO report. And I had to say, have you read it? As I've read it three times, and what you're saying is wrong. But let's be honest, that report is not completely in our favor for advocates of carbon pricing. There is some truth that the conservatives get it completely wrong, and they can't even take the little bit of truth and get it right. But there's a little bit of truth in the suggestion that the carbon pricing regime is going to be more costly than when we say it makes households whole. And so for those listening who haven't read the report, it's the difference between fiscal cash out of people's pockets and then cash back in, cash transfers, that fiscal basis. That does, on the PBO's analysis, make most people better off,
Better
actually,
off.
but makes overwhelmingly people whole. And so the poorest people you're talking about, they're hundreds of dollars better off at the end of the day, because we recycle the revenue. On an economic basis, though, the PBO says, well, hang on, carbon pricing, the price on pollution, does have a GDP cost, an economic cost. And so when you factor in both fiscal and economic costs over the long term, households are worse off. Most households are worse off on their analysis. Now, conservatives have really weaponized that, and they've
Now,
mistaken
obviously,
economic
when
for
the
fiscal.
PBO makes that, adds that whole economic dimensions to it, it's not, it's, I mean, he calculates what the impact is to Canada, divides it by the number of Canadians, and then he says, but it's not money that comes out of people's pocket.
Exactly. It's not money out of the people's pockets by any means. Yeah. And so
That
that's one pushback. The other pushback, I'm meeting the PBO later today, actually, to talk about this. So we'll see what comes. But there
Please
are.
tell him that he can't call it a carbon tax. It is not a tax. It doesn't go back to general. I like I I'm not he should know better.
There's a.
And the Supreme
Yes.
Court was very clear on that, but if you could kindly remind him that it's not a tax.
Well, my focus is going to be twofold, actually, and I wonder if you have any comment on this. I mean, one is there are other third-party reports, one from the American Economic Journal that looked at the EU carbon pricing regime, and they said there's no negative GDP impact. And so how does he square his analysis with other economic analyses in other with respect to other carbon price regimes? And then the second piece is, how do you credibly look at the economic costs of a certain climate action without analyzing what the cost would be for alternative climate action, which would be more costly if it was something else, regulatory or subsidy, or not, and how do you not have an alternative scenario for no climate action and what the economic costs would be there? And I mean, Environment Canada, or I don't know what third Canadian Climate Institute's done some of this work, but have you looked at the possibility of combating the PBO's report, and I think it's incorrect conclusion on the economic side, or at least the gaping caveat that they've got in there. Have you looked at how we start to marshal the facts to litigate the case otherwise?
Well, and in a recent interview, which you probably have seen, I mean, the PBO themselves himself recognizes that putting a price on pollution is I think he calls it one of the least disruptive, and I think these are his exact word. So, i.e., if you're serious about meeting your targets, then it, I mean, and obviously carbon pricing itself won't get us there. It's an important measure. It's about 30%, 30 to 40% of how we get to our 2030 targets. But there's another 60% of other things we need to do, whether it's regulatory investment. But he recognizes that it's one of, he calls it least disruptive. So if you don't do pricing, the things you're going to do are going to be more costly to Canadians, to the economy. Number one. Number two, he also recognizes that he didn't factor in the cost of climate change. It's having a cost to Canadians. It's, you know, I mean, some insurance company are saying that on average, and that's pre-2023, we've gone from $200 billion per year of annual cost to $2 billion per year of annual costs. And these are,
Wait,
I
say it
believe,
again. From 200 billion
we've gone
to.
from, I think it's Aon, the insurance company Aon, said that a decade ago, cost of climate change, insured cost, so it's not overall economic impact of natural catastrophes, it's gone from $200 million per year to
Oh,
two
200
billion
million to
dollars
2
per
billion.
year.
Right. And what, and obviously premium, like Financial Times had an interesting article the other day that talked about insurance premiums as a hidden carbon price.
Exactly, and in parts of the country, you can't, or it's very difficult to get insured against floodings or forest fires, because companies are reluctant to provide insurances in those areas. So he also recognizes that wasn't part of his analysis either. He says it's difficult to do. It's something I would like to do in the future. Some have done it, the Climate Institute and others as well. So I think, you know, I in answer to your question, I mean, it's difficult, you know, the Parliamentary Budget Officer being the institution it is in our parliamentary system, like it's unlikely Environment Canada would go out on the in the
Well, not
public and,
criticizing, but I mean more,
but we are
seeing
providing
more
we.
reports from the Canadian Climate Institute, and are there, just marshaling the facts to say that's one economist's view. Here are all the other economists' views, and like here I am Googling the American Economic Journal in advance of giving a speech. I think we do have to collectively marshal the facts better on that front.
Yeah, I agree, and we are providing the office of the Parliamentary Budget Officer with different facts on his analysis and pointing to. The idea is not to say he's wrong, but just to say, have you looked at this? Have you
You're
looked
too
at
polite. I'm
this?
going to say he's wrong, but he may correct, he may convince me otherwise at 1 p.m. today. You say 30 to 40%, that's carbon pricing. Now, the Canadian Climate Institute had a recent report that was a good thing in many ways, but actually is a challenging thing in another way. And I wonder how you're thinking about it. So they say 226 million tons, as I mentioned, already baked in. They say there's a lot more to do, but it's coming, and it's quite complementary. Carbon pricing, they chalk up to, I think, even more in and around the 79 megatons that Environment Canada assesses. But they basically say 22 megatons, so a much smaller portion, about 10% of the total emission reductions, come from consumer carbon pricing, and the rest come from industrial carbon pricing. And I know the two operate together in different ways, and you can maybe explain that. But do you think that's going to be a knock-on challenge where conservatives are going to jump up and say it's, killing people's pocketbooks? It's not. It's creating food bank lines? It's not. And it's only 10% of our total emissions, and they got to get rid of it. And the 10% part seems to be true.
It is. It is. I think it's very much in line with our own analysis at Environment and Climate Change. So yes, the price that large industrial emitters pay and the efforts that are doing are much bigger and account for much more of our emission reduction than what people at the pump and, you know, who uses natural gas or propane pay at home, for a couple of different reasons. I mean, obviously those companies are responsible for much more pollution. So if you tax every ton that they'll be or if you price every ton, there'll be more of it. But even, I mean, I don't disagree with the analysis that the fuel charge, what consumers pay directly, is about 10%. I've been like every day in the for the last 2 years and 79 days as environment and climate change minister, working with the department and team to try and find measures to help us reach our 2030 targets. If someone can point me in the direction of a measure that comes at no cost to Canadians, to taxpayers, where 8 out of 10 Canadians get more money back than our families get more money back than they pay, and that allows us to achieve 10% of our 2030 targets, show me the money. Because I
Yeah.
like if you
I think that's
invest.
got to be the answer back. It's got to be if you're going to account for another 10% of emission reductions in a different way, you got to be honest. It's going to cost the taxpayer more, number one. It's going to cost the taxpayer more. And
It's in the
let's,
billion, probably
yeah,
billions of dollars more.
exactly. So you either don't want to take climate action, which, let's be honest, is the truth for many conservatives across the aisle. Not all. I
And
spoke to
certainly
another.
the leader of the opposition.
Yeah, the leader and some of the more wacky members like Cheryl Gallant, and people just don't believe in, we're, I don't even know
You
how they would just.
fabricated
Well,
this
Cheryl
issue.
Gallant was quoting the Communist Manifesto the other day in the House talking about me. So there are, there's a different element in that caucus that doesn't believe in climate change at all.
I
But
think there are people in the conservative caucus that believe, but they lost that
yeah,
battle.
there
Like
definitely
they've
are. There
been
definitely are.
totally sidetracked and they can't even talk about it.
Yeah, I think there are different categories. There's a bigger chunk than we might like to believe that don't want any action at all. There's another category that wants some action politically, wants some action to be seen to be doing something, but not enough to upset any economics in terms of certain industries, especially oil and gas. And then there's the third piece, which is they want action. They'd be maybe different action, but it's the technology, not taxes line is a sop to
Well,
that
I
group.
mean, this idea that we'll tech our way out of this. First,
Yeah,
I mean, the Conservative Party is against our investment in electrification, so that's gone. They're against our investment in transit. So that's transport is about 25% of our emissions. So there goes 25% of our 2030 targets that we can't reach. They don't like, I mean, solar, wind, which are now dominating new energy production in this country, including in Alberta. More investment, and it's true worldwide. There, according to the International Energy Agency, there's almost 2 times more investment today in new electricity production from renewables than there is from fossil fuels. It's 1.7, so it's not quite two, 1.7 to one. But they don't like that either. So their technological solution, carbon capture and storage. Oh, okay. Well, we think it's part of the solution. Probably give us 7 or 8% of our emission reduction by 2030. Probably a little bit after 2030 in reality because of the time it will take to deploy it. But it's not. You don't get 50% of your emission reduction, and you certainly don't get 100% of your emission reduction by investing in this one technology. So this idea that, I mean, we'll do it through technology is BS. Like it's simply there. It doesn't stand to any serious analysis.
It's a slogan, and the slogan gets you a decent ways down the road when it comes to politics. But at some point, you've got to back it up
There
with
needs to be
some
some
serious plan.
substance.
Yeah, exactly. And we're a good ways away from that when it comes to this particular iteration of the conservatives. How do you,
I mean, I
communication?
love the fact that for the first time, I mean, when you look at the conservative, even under Harper, so in 2006 they didn't want any form of carbon pricing. Then they had a plan in 2008 where
They
they
talked about it.
wanted to they wanted to put a cap and trade system. Then I think in fact John Baird was both in favor and against at different time on the Harper government for carbon pricing. Then afterwards they were against it again. Then they were in favor. Then what what O'Toole, they were in favor, but it was a system, a carbon pricing system where you would be, it was pay to pollute as opposed to pollute or pay. It was a fascinating, like, but at least, I mean, it sounded good because they said, well, we're in favor of carbon pricing. Okay. And when you started looking at it, you were, so I'm eager to see what empty bumper sticker slogan they will come up, because I think they will have to come up with something when we get closer to the
I'm not
election.
well. Who, I hope I, you know, I hope they're forced to come up with something, and there's more
But I
accountability
think
on
it's
this
going to
front.
be totally, empty of any
Yeah,
substance, but it's
but
going to
on that,
sound good.
on the communication side, which we have struggled with at different times, I do think back to basics. I mean, they talk about common sense, and they're emphasizing this. You know, in Ontario, it harkens back to Mike Harris, which isn't the best thing to harken back to. But regardless, this idea of common sense conservatives, it is common sense to make polluters pay. And that is what pricing does. And we have to, in our own communication, I think, very simply talk about making polluters pay, because that is one, what I think the vast majority of Canadians think should happen. It is also what should happen. And it's a very simple message to communicate. But on communication, so we've at times struggled with this. You've rightly said, you know, I'm happy to fight an election on this, and we're going to get better, and we're going to go win this fight. And I was very glad to see that, because
And
we
the
need
Prime Minister
someone.
said that as well.
Yeah, exactly. And we got to take the fight back, and we got to win this fight. So that's on that. Have you, though, in this role, I don't want to go down the rabbit hole of talking about roads, but have you in this role, I mean, as an activist, you can say certain things off the cuff or otherwise, and you move on to the next day, and you say other things, and you're not knocked off message, and you're not having to explain and re-explain different comments. You're the Minister of Environment for a G7 country, and everything you say is scrutinized. And how have you navigated that? And the thing I'm referencing for people who don't know is that you made some comment in passing at a, I think it was on a panel, or I don't know what the panel was for exactly, but something climate related, no doubt.
Public transit.
Public transit, right. And you weren't saying we're not making investments in roads. You were really talking about certain large, I would say in Ontario, the 413. You were talking about another network in Quebec. But these large scale, unnecessary, destructive transit projects, big highway projects,
Road projects.
yeah, big highway projects are not what we're interested in at all, and we're not going to fund. But that got torqued, and lack of clarity for sure. And you clarified afterwards. But just I don't really want to go down the rabbit hole of the roads so much as which you've clarified. But just the how you're the environment minister, and you've got to make sure that you're crystal clear. Otherwise, every day your words are going to be weaponized against you and against the government.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would prefer to try and be as genuine as possible in my communication, and sometimes paying the price of it than being this tasteless, colorless, flavorless politician who's afraid of saying anything because it could come back and bite him.
Yeah, that's
I,
fair.
if I if I have to choose between the two, and maybe my comms director would have a different opinion if he was here, but I as a some before being in politics, I hated people who were like that, who would never say anything because they were so afraid of how it would be interpreted. I think we need to have, in French we say, we need to have the courage of our convictions,
Yeah,
roughly
that's right.
translated.
No,
So
yeah, that's right.
we're serious about fighting climate change and sustain all those sustainability challenges, plastic pollution and nature, or we're not. And it means changing a number of way we do things as a government. We're now using infrastructure dollars, which traditionally went to pavement and concrete, to do nature-based solutions. We're funding parks that will help alleviate spring floodings in parts of the country. We're trying. I mean, we are changing a number, and some are very visible, like carbon pricing, and some, like those investments from Infrastructure Canada into nature, are not so visible, but so impactful and so important in terms of getting us as a government and the civil service to try and think differently about these things.
And yet, there's the So I completely agree with that idea of authenticity, and I think you ultimately earn trust in the long run by being authentic, and the risks of that authenticity are worth it in comparison to the, I think, greater risks ultimately of lackluster conformity. Having said that, in the political environment, it's not just I say one thing and I then can have the opportunity freely to explain it, and I speak in paragraphs, and I love that politics. But the politics that you live in, and that I would have lived in if I've been more successful provincially, the conservative machine is there to weaponize and distort, and I would say uncharitably weaponize certain words that you use out of context to score points. And you get it from not only the leader of the opposition, but how do you manage these provincial relationships? I mean, on the one hand, you get some reasonable, I disagree with this statement, but I don't think it's out of completely beyond beyond the pale. Fossil fuels are not the problem, emissions are the problem, and Ottawa's top priority should be working with provinces and finding more effective ways to help industry cut emissions in practical ways across all sectors. That's the Alberta Environment Minister. Now, that skates because obviously fossil fuels drive emissions, and they are a big part of the problem because you can't just cut emissions and keep fossil fuel and keep burning fossil fuels. Welcome to science. But that's very different. That's very different from Premier Smith, who says of you and some of your actions, Albertans will not forget his continued treachery. Like that's like beyond anything I would expect from
I
Canadian
hadn't heard
politics.
this one before, and I've heard quite a few from her. Actually, the environment minister in that particular statement was rather nice to me. She can be, I mean, she's very much in line with her premier on this, and many of her statements are aligned. I mean, I think, you know, when it clearly these statements are not aimed for, I would argue, for the general public. They're aimed at reinforcing the base of Danielle Smith. And the same is true for Scott Moe in Saskatchewan and you know, Doug Ford in Ontario. I think that most people would see those comments and go, come on, like this is over the top. Yeah, unless
Yeah,
you're a
treachery is.
staunch.
I read that. And I was like, what country are we living in right now?
I met a bunch of mayors from small towns in the house last week, and you know, if you believe the Conservative Party, I mean, they should have wanted to, you know, rip my head out because of my comments on roads. Not one of them spoke to me about roads. I've been meeting farmers, blueberry farmers in Saskatchewan, dairy farmers in different parts of the country, cattle farmers from Alberta in recent weeks. None of them spoke to me about carbon pricing. They've all been talking to me about climate impacts.
Yes. Which
Water in Alberta, like this cattle farm, it's been in a family for generations, like three generations or maybe four, I believe. They've had to cut their stock in half because there's not enough water. That's what they wanted to talk to me about.
Yeah, it's really a question of resilience. I just got off a call. It's focused on large urban centers around the world, but it's a resiliencies index for cities that The Economist put out. And there
Oh,
was
yeah.
this knock-on conversation around what would a resiliencies index look like for smaller municipalities in the Canadian context? Because I think that is what many municipalities and political actors are looking for, is how are we going to manage the impacts, as you put it? How are we going to be resilient in the face of the impacts? And how are we going to have a federal government that helps us
Which are here.
to adapt, which are here? Yeah, exactly.
It's no longer like 30 years ago when I started talking about this, we thought, you know, everybody, the scientists thought, you know, oh, those impacts we'll see in 2050, 2060. It's now.
And you've been in this game for a long time. Catherine McKenna wrote recently, and Jean Charest wrote recently in the wake of Mulroney's passing, and obviously lionizing the former prime minister's efforts on the environmental file in particular. And conservatives in Canada used to lead in this way. I was not really following politics given my age at the time, but you read the historical record and there's certainly truth to it. And even the UK Conservatives today, I mean, 2006, they put in place a UK climate accountability law. They have a an excess profits tax on oil and gas as we speak under this current Conservative administration. And yet, conservatives in Canada are so far away from Brian Mulroney. They're so far away
There's
from,
nothing left of
yeah. What?
his
What?
legacy.
And it's the Reform Party just took over? Is that your view, or what? How?
Yep, absolutely. Yep, totally. And the progressive conservatives are marginalized within this party. Their ideas are akin to heresy. So there's nothing left of the progressive in the conservative today. Especially on the environment, acid
I
rain,
want to get
ozone
to
depletion, Earth Summit 1992.
it's if you had a conservative government today and you had the necessary leadership for tackling the ozone and acid rain, you might not have solved the problem.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's a scary idea. What now? I've dwelled on a couple of examples of imperfections in the liberal record, but I haven't really, but I haven't really gone down that road too much. I had Laurel Collins on the podcast, and she was more forceful in her criticism for sure. You're sitting there, and you go, "If I look at the progress report and I take it seriously, you've got your main job right now is to make sure you implement the in progress and announced policies with great stringency and seriousness. But your
There's
second
a
job is
couple
to
more
make."
we have to develop, the
Well, so yeah, so I
electricity
want
and the cap, yeah.
exactly. So you've got that work ahead in terms of stringency, which I'd like you to speak to. Actually, let's start there. I've got a second question, but so the work that's underway, what occupies your time, and what are you working as hard as you can on to make sure it's realized in as serious a way as possible?
So we have two, I'd say, two big piece of policy left to deploy on climate. Not to say that there aren't other things we need to do, but two big ticket items. One is the clean electricity regulation, a commitment that our grid be carbon neutral or close to carbon neutral by 2035.
I think that was your treachery, by the way. That's the treachery that you're
Oh,
responsible for.
yes, right, of
Yeah.
course. Even though, you know, 70 in 2022, 75% of renewable energy deployment in Canada took place in Alberta. I'm being treacherous to the people of Alberta for wanting more renewables. Meanwhile, she's putting a moratorium on what has been the largest energy development, well, electricity development in her province over the last 7 or 8 years, putting thousands of jobs at risk and billions of dollars worth of investment, but that's not treacherous to the people of Alberta. So yeah, I mean, we decarbonizing the grid is really the basis for everything we need to do if we ever hope, not so much in 2030, because I mean we won't get there before 2035 or a little bit after, but to get to carbon neutrality, I mean if the electricity we consume in our buildings continues to be produced by fossil fuels in our vehicles, in our industries, you can't, there's only so much of technology you can use to suck carbon out of industrial processes. You can do it, but it's not a silver bullet. And
Right. If
when
you
you
keep
look,
expanding natural gas the way Ontario is expanding it, you are not going to find yourself in a sustainable future.
and you lock in people into more price increase in electricity because one, natural gas is more expensive than renewables right now in Canada. But two, if you're serious about climate and you continue investing in those natural gas plant to produce electricity, then you need to suck those emissions out of those plant. It's not cheap.
Yeah.
Like it's a very expensive proposal to ratepayers in Alberta and in Saskatchewan and in Ontario. Which is not to say they won't be any more gas-fired electricity produce after 2035, but we need to minimize it as much as possible and maximize the use of battery technology and deploy renewables massively. So that's so we've presented the draft regulations, and now we have to finalize those regulations so that they can come into force. I mean, obviously the regulations doesn't enter into force per se before 2035, but for that to happen, companies need to see that, you know, okay, what are the final regulations? What are the rules so that they can start making their investment decisions? And this will be completed by, I'd say, the middle of the year, probably beginning of fall at the latest. And the other one is the oil and gas cap. So we want to cap the emissions of the oil and gas sector, which is also, I mean, you know, if that if that if this is what Danielle Smith said of what I'm doing trying to do on electricity, you can imagine what she will say about the capping the pollution from the oil and gas sector. We presented a sort of a white paper before Christmas on some of the, you know, 20,000 feet main elements of what the regulations would look like. We're due to present the regulations for that also probably middle of the year, beginning of fall as well.
And
And
both of
then
these policies are examples of, when I say this isn't just about axing the tax, this is about axing
no.
serious climate action. Both of those policies in a conservative-led
Oh.
government after the next election are gone immediately. They're the first on the chopping block.
Carbon pricing, clean electricity
Clean electricity,
regulation, and the
cap on
oil
oil
and
and
gas
gas
cap would
emissions.
be the probably the first three to
Yeah,
go
and
in.
we should say, like, even if conservatives were to keep industrial pricing, if you look at the Canadian Climate Institute report, the cap on oil and gas emissions is a huge part of emission reductions to where we need to get. So we've talked about
And
where
the
what you're working
analysis of
on.
the Climate Institute was to 2030, but a
Exactly.
number of these measures will have much more
Yeah, they'll
impact
bite even harder
after
after
to
2030.
20, yeah.
What, so I asked you about what you're working on today. You've still got a delta. You implement everything you've got underway with a great stringency, and say you get all the way down to 467, which is what your Environment Canada tells us we are aiming for, or we're on the trajectory towards, I should say. There's still a delta, though, from that to the 40% emission reductions we've promised, and there's a delta even beyond to where we ostensibly need to get if you follow the IPCC.
The science, yeah.
What's the next thing you want to see? And what the activist world, you're there to be the activist in government. What's the next thing you want to see?
Well, there are things that are very difficult to model. For example, transit. We get almost, you know, despite 30 billions of investment between roughly 2018 and 2030, we get almost, according to modeling, to economic modeling, we get almost no emission reduction. Now we know obviously that we will, but these are very, it's very difficult to model. So we will, and it's hard to account in what we do. That we are looking at other things that we could do to ensure that we do bridge that gap. I mean, for example, the so-called OPBS, the output-based pricing system. So what large industrial emitters have to pay. There is a review that's going to take place, I believe, next year, I think in 2025 or maybe 2026. So that would be a possibility. We could decide after that to strengthen it even more to get us more emission reduction. I think that on the building side of things, there's much more we could do, we can and should be doing to help us reduce emissions there as well. But in terms of transportation, I mean, so we have a zero emission vehicle mandate now in Canada. That will help between that and transit. That will help us tackle not all of the emissions of the transportation sector because our zero emission vehicle standard is for light duty vehicles. We are looking at what we could do for medium and heavy duty vehicles. It's much more complicated, like so much more different categories of vehicles. The technology is there for certain category, like school buses, for example,
Sure.
local delivery trucks, but it's not for long haulers and things like that. But this is another element we're looking at as well. So there's a number of other things we're looking to see how we bridge the remaining gap.
I have to ask you, so tough question and then an easier sort of follow-up. The 413, this is not Quebec politics. It matters a great deal, Ontario politics, and it matters in different ways, right? So some people, if you're talking to people in Peel region, they would say we need more transportation options, and whether it's the 413 or some other, probably it would have made more sense to pay for the provincial government to pay to put the trucks on the 407 and clear up space on your existing transit. Having said that, they're looking to spend billions of dollars in what is going to be the provincial government's boondoggle on this 413. We were an obstacle at one point, and we're not an obstacle anymore. And can you walk through, for the layperson who's outraged by this or is, getting the emails from the David Suzuki Foundation and saying, how dare the federal government drop its challenge or environmental assessment, I should say, and requirement under the Impact Assessment Act? What do you say to them?
Unfortunately, there was a decision by the Supreme Court at the end of last year that said, and if you listen to the if you listen to the Conservative Party or conservative pundits seem to indicate that our Impact Assessment Act is unconstitutional. It's not what the Supreme Court said. The Supreme Court said part of the Impact Assessment Act that was adopted in 2019 is unconstitutional. Other parts are very constitutional. Unfortunately, the 413 falls in the category of what the Supreme Court called overreach by the federal government. And basically, right now, until we correct legislatively what the Supreme Court told us, we basically have no legal leg to stand on for provincial projects. That's the unfortunate reality of that Supreme Court ruling. So the Supreme Court says, federal government on federal projects still has impact to powers to do impact assessment. Now, it's not to say that there's nothing we can do on projects like 413, because the Supreme Court did say that on issues like the Species at Risk Act, which is under Environment and Climate Change, we still have responsibilities and obligations, and those obligations apply as well to provincial as well as federal project. So if a proposed Highway 413 project was to have impact on habitat for species at risk, then there are federal levers that can be used. If there are impacts on navigable water, which by Canadian law means any body of water, a small river, then the Department of Fisheries and Oceans will have to investigate, will have to look into it. So it's not to say there's nothing we can do, but to a full-blown impact assessment like was envisaged just a few months ago is no longer possible with the Supreme Court ruling.
I do wish we'd amended our law more quickly and then had a bigger fight at court to at least have the court weigh in fully instead of us entirely standing down and my having to trust in justice officials. Having said that, the question's been
Here
answered.
we are.
Here we are. Okay, so I want to leave you with a couple things and then maybe you could speak to this particular issue, which I think you and the government have been great on in many ways. But so I first want to just run down for listeners. So we are now, if all the actions have been implemented, we're 36% of the way towards what is ultimately we've said we want to get to 40%, we're at
40%, right?
36%, right?
36%. Yep.
So now, if you look at that 815 megatons, which is business as usual, it's actually a 43% reduction if we do everything we say we want to do, because 850 megatons was if you had conservative inaction, it just would have kept growing. It wasn't like
Yep.
your baseline stays the same. No, it would have
Nope.
grown. So there's even it's actually even more serious action. Now,
Yep.
if you go by sector, buildings will decrease in emissions by 2030 if policies hold. Electricity, you see a major decrease in, because of the actions you're
Massive.
talking about. Heavy industry decrease. Oil and gas, major decrease, albeit still significant emissions. Transportation, a more modest decrease than I expected, but still a decrease. Waste, decrease. Agriculture, no decrease. So it's worth thinking about that as well, although I understand the politics of that are fraught as well. Now, to get to the last thing on animal protections writ large, nature protections, You've got a government bill, the government version of the Jane Goodall Act is very well received. My ask of you is that you strengthen that in working with advocates as much as you can, because there are some ways to strengthen it. The advocates are mostly aligned on that. Two, phasing out toxicity testing on animals, that's great. It was a platform commitment. Kudos to you for getting it through CEPA in
Well,
terms of the
health.
amendments.
I mean, we worked on this, but Health Canada
Yeah, it was the
and the
lead. It was the
minister
lead. It was the
was
lead.
also a lot of help on that.
And a nature accountability law is coming, which you can maybe speak to. But in all of this, I think it's really important that we see through. We've got the Jane Goodall Act. That's great. Let's see it through. She's going to be here at some point in April. You should probably meet with her and take advantage of that. On phasing out toxicity testing, we've got to implement it. So same, there's a center at the University of Windsor that we should fund that is currently closing down, unfortunately, that does this kind of work and could be part of our overall agenda. Speak to me about the nature accountability law and how it fits within this agenda. And this is going to be my last question, so you can close with that. But also, if there's other, in closing, you want anything you want people to know about the work that you're doing, the work that the government's doing on this, then fire away.
Well, so we talked a lot, rightly so, about climate change, but I think another important piece of work we've been doing since 2015, so before my arrival, but certainly since my arrival, is on nature. When the Prime Minister is elected in 2015, Canada doesn't even protect 1% of its oceans and coastline. And we had under a previous UN agreement, we had an agreement which the Conservative nothing about to get to 20% by 2030. So we obviously didn't get there. Now for oceans and coastline protection, we went from less than 1% to about 15%. That's where we are now. If all goes well, by the end of the year, we could be at 20%. And for terrestrial, we've gone up as well, not as much as we've gone on. I mean, we haven't made as much progress, but we have made progress on terrestrial protection. So we're a little bit below 15% right now. We could also get to close to 20 by the end of the year. We have a commitment under COP15, which was held in Montreal at the end of 2022, to be at 30% land and oceans protection, at least 30% by 2030. And just to give you I mean, it's massive investment, like historic investment, $5 billion by the federal government. But I think that, so the investments are certainly notable. But I think what has really changed is the fact that now most, if not all, of these projects are indigenous-led. Just before Christmas, we announced a memorandum of understanding with the government of the Northwest Territories, the Indigenous nations and governments of the Northwest Territories, and the federal government to protect 1 million square kilometer of land in the territories, which is four times the size of the United Kingdom. We're doing massive, massive projects with Indigenous nations. We're doing another very, very big one with Inuits in Nunavut, as well as in Labrador, the Great Bear Sea on the West Coast. We're trying to get a project off the ground in Northern Ontario. For a long time, the government of Ontario was a no-show, and unfortunately, it's terrestrial. So we need provinces when it's terrestrial, because they have the constitutional powers over these lands. But so do Indigenous. I mean, as you can imagine, it's a difficult balance. But I think Premier Ford made some interesting comments recently on this, and opening the door where the door had been very, very much shut for many years. So I think we'll be able to make some progress there. And one of the commitments we made following COP15 is that we would adopt a. So we have a Climate Accountability Act that was adopted in Parliament, which is largely it's an inward government-facing act that obliges our government and future governments to do a certain number of things when it comes to being more transparent on climate change. What are our plans? How are we making progress? Having to table things in the House of Commons, having to consult Canadians and Indigenous nations and provinces and territories. it's not perfect, but I think it has a lot of merits, and it is through this act that I table in 2022 the first emission reduction plan
Yeah.
ever to see the light of
And
day in
so taking the
Canada.
same idea for the nature accountability
Exactly.
piece.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean,
makes sense.
it's not going to be, a mirror act, but it's going to be
Similar in terms of its
similar.
mechanism.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for joining me. I have to ask, in closing, I said the last is going to be my last, but you have faced withering criticism from some quarters we've talked about, and communications, frustrations, and all of that. You've got a history of activism where you undoubtedly want the government to go faster and further, and you're hearing that. I've probably got an earful at times from friends and colleagues from the past. Are you glad you made the decision you made to enter politics in 2019? Have you made the difference you set out to make?
So I mean, yes, I'm glad. And I didn't come into politics because I felt that activism outside government doesn't have a role to play. It certainly does.
Yeah, of course, yeah. Everyone's got a role, yeah.
But I felt that my after being an activist outside government for 25 years, I felt it was time for me to try and continue my work in a different forum. And that's what I did. And I'm very, very happy, and frankly feel very privileged to be
Despite all the
doing
nights
what
of lonely spaghetti, it was the
I'm
right
doing.
decision.
It was
Well,
the right
I
decision.
appreciate you joining me.
Thank you very much, Nate. Take care.
Thanks for joining me on this episode of Uncommons. If you haven't already, do head to uncommons.ca, subscribe there for updates, including both podcasts, but also more writing. And more shamelessly, please do leave a 5-star review on your platform of choice if you haven't already, and if you like what we're doing. I also have to add, this podcast is designed to be more of a deep dive, but I'm not above doing the occasional talk radio. So I went on Jerry Agar's show the other day to explain how pricing pollution works and how the rebate works. And we show back and forth a bit. And I end the show by saying, embracing my inner talk radio host, that we have to put an end to this axe the tax bullshit. Well, Agar then goes on to write a ridiculous hit job on pricing pollution in the Sun. And he writes, Liberal MP Nathaniel Erskine-Smith got so angry when I brought up the PPO that he swore at me on live radio. Now, there are two things. First, I'm old enough. I'll be 40 this June. I'm old enough to remember when conservatives called liberals snowflakes. And I've got to say, writing in a national newspaper that you got sworn at when that's clearly not what happened is real snowflake behavior, Jerry. The second thing, just on the PBO, and if you do head to Uncommons, I did break this down a little bit there, but the PBO report's getting thrown back and forth. I said in this conversation with Gilboa that I thought the PBO got it wrong. I did engage with the PBO, as I mentioned to Stephen that same day. And in fairness, they were very generous with their time, wicked smart people. And they basically said two things back to me. One, when I said, there's economic analyses that suggest that it's not going to have this GDP hit. They said, yeah, we use a different model and we stand by our model. We stand by our assessment, and economists in Canada support our assessment as well. So be it. Different models, different results. The second piece, though, and this is my real frustration, that what value to a parliamentarian is the report when there's no economic analysis of the costs of climate change, unchecked climate change, inaction, and there's no assessment of the economic costs of alternative action, which obviously is more costly. And to the PBO's credit, they first likened climate action to sending weapons to the Ukraine, where they said, yeah, it might be easy to assess the upfront costs. It's obviously hard to assess the long-term benefits, but it's still the right thing to do regardless. And the second thing they said is, there's a letter from over 150 economists recently that's saying the same thing, but they acknowledged pricing pollution is the most cost-effective way of reducing emissions, acknowledging that alternative action would, of course, be more costly. So, in fairness to the PBO, wicked smart people, I still disagree with putting out an economic analysis that, in a vacuum, doesn't really tell us a whole lot, doesn't tell a decision maker really anything without alternatives that are costed as well. But I appreciate in their mandate is to cost the specific proposal in front of them, and they're in a no-win situation, as we kind of talked about. Anyway, that's all to say. Check out my piece at uncommons.ca. We're aiming to follow up with some video on that as well, so look out for that. And otherwise, until next time.